This episode is brought to you by Apeel. Apeel is a plant-based protective layer that helps produce last up to twice as long. Learn more at Apeel.com.
Welcome to Cooking in Mexican from A to Z. My name is Aaron Sanchez.
And I'm Sarela Martinez.
And today we're really, really excited. Super pumped up to invite a special guest, somebody that's very near and dear to both myself and my mother. He's a gentleman that really was instrumental in my maturation as a chef and as a cook. He took really good care of me in probably one of the most important jobs that I had coming up and learning our trade. And that gentleman is Jorge Adrianzola. And Jorge was one of the former chefs at Patria. He was my boss back in the day. And currently, he's the executive chef and consultant at Castro, Uptown Social, and Tio Luca. And we thought we'd bring in Jorge today to talk about a subject that I think is an absolute building block of flavor, right? And such an essential ingredient, and it's plantains.
Yes, and what I love about it is that it's the perfect example of Afro-Mexican cooking. You know, I put up some information on it on my website, sarela.com, and people said, I didn't even know that it existed. Mm-hmm. And of course it existed. It's all the way down the coast in Veracruz. When Cortes arrived in Mexico, he already had with him an African slave, mm-hmm. and more would come and bring the cuisine. And I find it that is so adaptable to so many different kinds of cooking in Mexico.
Yeah, and the plantain is such an essential ingredient in so many different cuisines all over the world. You think about Africa and that ingredient kind of migrating through the Caribbean and then making its way to Mexico, obviously Central and South America. Jorge, your background is you're Peruvian born. You were actually a merchant marine back in the day. You came to the States to go to school, and then you got into the kitchen as a hobby and a way to sort of supplement your income, and then you took it on as a full career.
How long were you on it as a full career?
Full time. I was working full time and part time going to school. Mm. I went through different cuisines until I ended up working at Patria, Cayocha. That's where I met you. That's where I had the honor to meet your mother. Mm-hmm. And like you said, I mean, you back in the day, you were a kid.
Yeah.
And I always push you, mm-hmm. and it's an honor now that I could see you and you're this big celebrity chef.
Well, it's been great, Jorge. You taught me not only lessons in the kitchen, but also very essential lessons in life, how to be a man, how to be responsible. You really did so many things for my career that I just have an opportunity to thank you here on this beautiful podcast.
No need.
Well, today we're going to be focusing on plantain. So what is a plantain, Mom?
Well, it comes from a plant. Everybody thinks that a banana tree, it's a banana tree. No, it's a plant. What I love about this plantain story is that it's another example of an ingredient that is used at all different types of maturation, and every part of the plant is used. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the leaves are used for tamales, they're used to make sacahuil. The trunks are used to make the bed of the sacahuil that you cover with the banana leaves and then put the dough in. So sacahuil is a gigantic tamal. It's either done in the oven or it's done on top of the stove in some places. But the sacahuil is about 6 feet long, so they cut the leaves like that. And then you make a liquid masa, marinate some big chunks of pork, big chunks of chicken, and put them in that, and then cover it with more leaves, and lots of lard, by the way. And then, which I love, by the way, lard is not bad for you if you home render it. You know, they used to call me the lard queen. But anyway, if you home render it, it's 2/3 unsaturated. And it has oleic acid, which is the same thing that olive oil has, which helps break down cholesterol, which explains why my aunts lived to be 98 years old eating lard every single day. So I've been trying to bring the reputation of lard to the forefront for many, many years. So the in Veracruz, what they do is that they put it in the oven that they bake the bread. So when they turn the oven off, they put the zacahuil in for the night, and then it's ready in the next morning to serve for breakfast. And you go to restaurants, and they all they're serving is this big tamal, and the big moment is when they take off the leaves, and all this wonderful smell comes out, and this luscious concoction is, you know, is there for everybody to enjoy.
Make me hungry.
Yeah. So let's focus a little bit on the different varieties of plantains, okay? So, you know, I think it's important to mention to our listeners that they are inedible when raw, okay? So plantains have to be cooked. So there's, you know, you think about the basics. We have the green plantain, so it's an underripe plantain, and it's more starchy. It has a starchier content. It's used more in savory applications as opposed to sweet. And then once that matures and it starts, it has this grungy kind of black speckled exterior that becomes a maduro or sweet plantain. And they also call it plátano macho. And that's when you start getting more of those essential sugars coming out as the plantain ripens.
Many, many years ago, we did a video of you teaching us how to peel a green plantain, mm-hmm. which is really hard to do, you know. So you remind us how you do it.
Well, I learned it from Jorge, actually. You know, you take the green plantains, you cut off each end, then you kind of score it, the skin, and put it into hot water or boiling hot water till it turns black. And that allows the actual green plantain skin to kind of detach itself from the actual flesh of the plantain.
Make it easy for to peel it.
To peel it, yeah. But if you go into some traditional Latin countries, people actually do it with their hands, like with, you know, with just their nails. And, you know, that's the old school way.
Which I saw in Dominican Republic and in the fields.
Yeah.
I mean, I was amazed the way they did it. And very fast, too.
Yeah.
Well, when you take that green plantain, you can make the maduros with it. I mean, can you make the tostones with it?
Yes.
That's, I guess, would be the primary use of it. Green, no?
Yeah. Well, consider it a starch, like you would use, like you would almost use a potato. You can make chips with it. You can make purees with it. You know, we talk about the tostón, which is a twice fried green plantain. Yes. What are some of the other ones, Jorge?
We could use in stews too, like a thickened the stews.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I told you about a year ago, I did gnocchis mm-hmm. with it, with a little flour, and you add a little lard, which is nothing wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the lard got a bad rap in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately. And you're right about that. I mean, it's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
I remember Kurt Vonnegut said to me, isn't it ridiculous how people make such a big deal about something that they would never eat anyway?
True.
Exactly. Yeah, so, you know, you talk about the different usages. So green plantain, the most traditional way that you would see it, especially if you're talking about Puerto Rican cuisine or Caribbean Latin cuisine, is the tostones, which in essence is a twice-fried green plantain.
Mariquitas.
Mariquitas, which is which would be like thinly shaved chips. Then you kind of move into the world of mashing it. So then you have something that's very typical in the Dominican Republic called mangú.
Mofongo.
You have the mofongo.
Pastelón.
The mofongo is something that they do in Puerto Rico where they actually they take the green plantain, they put it into a mortar and pestle to kind of open it up, and then they fill it with different pork and different fillings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do that in Veracruz as well.
Yes, absolutely. And then, then when you start to work with it, you know, you can actually take green plantains, cook them, and then kind of layer them to use almost like a lasagna, which they call the pastelón, which is great. Green plantains are an essential ingredient in making pasteles as well.
Oh, yeah.
We're making the sort of Caribbean-style tamales. And then when you move over to the sweet plantain arena, let's talk about some different applications for that.
Well, let's do one more green thing because that's important. In Veracruz, you shave the green plantain and put it in masa. To go and make tortillas with it.
Yes. Mm.
So it's just wonderful. I mean, it's just delicious because it's a little bit starchy and it holds the tortilla very well together.
And, you know, and the green plantain doesn't have a lot of inherent flavor. It's very neutral in its flavor. So you really need to, you know, it's a perfect foil for putting bean purees and dipping it in a garlicky mojo and those sorts of things that can really sort of lift it up a little bit.
A word of caution, if you're going to be cooking with plantains, you make sure that you have the right degree of ripeness. Mm-hmm. Because this is not one of those things that you can put on your shopping list and go say, I'm going to go get a plantain, because, mm-hmm. you know, probably will not be ripe enough, or it'll be too ripe. You know? So it's very important to plan ahead when you're going to be cooking with plantains.
Yeah, and preferably go to a Latin market, you know, where they have some experience
gotta know
in them.
Which plantain you got to pick.
How long do you think a green plantain takes to ripen? And what is the best way to get them ripe?
Well, I mean, it varies. You know, ideally, you would put them in a dry storage area.
Exactly. That's what we used to do in the basement, dry, and let it sit there by itself.
You want to cover them, though.
Yes.
Because they get bugs, and they get prone mm-hmm. to a lot of different
yes.
things.
Yeah, you got to cover them.
But, yeah, I mean, it depends, Mom. I mean, put into a nice sort of ambient temperature room, like a dry storage, and let it do its thing. And I think if you went from green, Jorge, to ripe, maybe a couple weeks.
A couple of weeks, I would say. It depends on the temperature of the room, too.
So they don't. Most bananas and plantains get transported green.
Yes.
So when they go to a produce distributor, they're put in a room and they get some sort of gas.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
To get them ripened. So this is why it's very important to plan ahead. I mean, I can't stress that enough.
I agree with you.
Just like you would do an avocado, you buy an avocado green.
Exactly.
And then let it ripen on its own, and then when you're ready to use it, go for it. So plan ahead, basically, is what you're saying, right? So once you get, you know, we talked a little bit about the green plantain, all the different applications. Think of it as a potato. It's very amenable to big flavor. It's kind of neutral as far as its flavor profile. And once you get to the sweet plantain arena, what are some of those different applications and different recipes that I think are out there? Because there's so many.
Remember the fufu.
Yeah.
We used to mix it with the onions, sauteed onions, and bacon.
Yeah. Love. And that was a beautiful puree.
That was a beautiful puree. A lot of flavor.
Yeah.
The sweetness and the savory from the bacon and the onions.
Yeah.
Well, that's what in Veracruz, they do it. They saute jalapenos and plenty of garlic, cook the plantain, which, by the way, if you cook it ahead of time, it's going to turn hard as a rock. So this is where a microwave really helps a lot to soften it, you know, again. But it's a different flavor. But what you do is, you know, there's three levels of lard. Take some chicharrones, which is the last level of rendering lard.
Mm-hmm.
You mash it up with the plantains, saute it with jalapenos and lots of garlic, and then you serve it as a side dish, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds nice like flavors. A little fufu. That's very similar.
Yeah, yeah. I like the spiciness. I like the idea of putting jalapenos in that because it contrasts the sweetness from the plantain and the spiciness.
Yeah.
And then you have the flavor of the lard or the chicharrón.
Yeah.
One of the traditional dishes I had on my menu at Centrico forever were the plátano rellenos. So I used
that
to do sweet plantains, cook them, then I would put them in a tortilla press to flatten them out. Then I would put a smoked black bean puree with queso Oaxaca. And then I would fold those back up.
Yeah.
And then fry them and then serve them just with crema.
That's wonderful.
So that beautiful contrast of the cheese and crema, sweetness and smokiness really is a beautiful little touch.
It's almost similar. I took the plantain, the sweet plantain whole with a peel and put in the oven.
Mm.
And then let it cook there for 10 minutes, and then I have a stew of bacalao.
Yeah.
Put on top, too. That's a nice idea, because you have the sweetness and the saltiness from the bacalao. Mm-hmm. You know, it's contrast there.
And I had a version of that on my menu at Paladar for many years, the stuffed plantain with bacalao.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I have on my website, I put up a whole section on how to cook plantains and how to stuff them. Poor Jan Birnbaum, who is now gone, the chef that you work with, with Paul Prudhomme,
mm-hmm.
and they show you exactly how to make a plátano relleno.
Yeah.
And I have it there, so look at sarela.com and look plantains, and you'll find many, many recipes related to plantains.
And one of your signature staple dishes you had at Sarela's for over 25 years, Mom, was just fried plantains, sweet plantains with mole.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that... I mean, think about the mole and, its inherent sweetness and its complexity with the little the sweetness and the fried texture of the sweet plantains. It was a perfect marriage.
And yeah. the chilies.
Yeah, and the chilies.
All that combination of Englishness.
Yeah.
Well, they used a lot in stuffings with picadillo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that too.
You know, when you want to stuff, like say, a smoked chili that we've spoken about a lot, you stuff the plantain with the picadillo with pork, plantains, apples, whatever, it's, and cinnamon, canela, actually, which we will talk about, the Mexican cinnamon, which is not Mexican, but in any case, that's what it's called. So that's another way of using it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important to mention that, you know, when you want to get into maybe some of the sweet arena, there is some very simple ways to kind of use it in a sort of a dessert format. Something simple, you know, if you're out there barbecuing or grilling and you have some coals, you know, wrap those plantains in some foil, just jam them in the coals, cook them, and then maybe put a little bit of melao or a little bit of piloncillo or like a brown sugar in there while they cook, and you have this very sweet, beautiful sort of glazed roasted plantain.
I did that with maple syrup.
Yeah, with maple syrup, same thing. So it does make a lot of sense. You can, so if you wanted to use sweet plantain in a dessert application, there's, you know, think of like a, almost like a carrot cake, but using plantain. You can do many different things.
How about your dish that you created very early on that was called Bananas Fausto?
Oh yeah. So this was a really fun dish. So, you know, my time in New Orleans, you learned the famous Bananas Fosters, right?
Yes.
And that dish is basically tableside flambéed bananas with cognac or brandy, or, you know, to create the whole flambé, and you serve it in a butter sauce. So I took that premise and did it with plantains, but instead of brandy, I put rum, and then I put a little bit of piloncillo or vanilla, or the, you know, an unrefined brown sugar.
Yep.
And then I would flambé with the rum, and I called it Bananas Faustos.
And how about the other dish?
Instead of Bananas Fosters.
Do you remember the other dish that was, you were so clever? I mean, you still are, but you were very clever very early on. But you did papá and hijo.
Oh, yeah.
That you used to do a fried plantain with some salmon roe.
Oh, yeah.
And the creme fraiche.
Yeah, well, we did. So I used to use the plantain, like make a tostón, basically. Put a little beautiful cube, then I'd put some beautiful smoked salmon from Russ and Daughters.
Nice.
Yeah.
Which was around the corner from my restaurant. And then I would get some salmon roe, and I would put a little lemon crema fresca, and then chive, and then just put the little smoked salmon, and then the roast. It'll be dad and equal, the eggs.
You know what? We keep on talking about making a tostón.
Yeah.
I really think that you need to explain about that, because there are even little forms to make. You know, there's a tostón maker that you kind of press like a tortilla.
Yeah.
So explain.
Yeah, Jorge, tell them what you have to cook it like you would blanch a French fry. You have to cook it
exactly
lower.
Exactly, low temperature, 250 degrees for a while. So make it a little, in order to cook the whole entire plantain, and you cut it, of course, you have the plantain, the whole plantain, you cut it in pieces.
Yeah, about four maybe or five. One inch.
1.5 inch, it depends how you like it. And then let it cook there for 5 to 10 minutes, depending on the thickness of the plantain. And then take it out. As they are hot, you just mash it. And when you're ready to serve it, you refry it at 350 degrees.
Yeah, at a higher temperature.
A higher temperature.
To get the crispiness in there.
Exactly. And so, then
yeah.
Once they're cooked and crispy, then you salt it and the traditional mojo, which is a nice ingredient.
Garlic.
Yeah, tons of garlic. But garlic. So just to be clear, to allude to what my mom was saying, so in essence, like, this is how you would make French fries at home, by the way, guys.
Yes, exactly.
You would cut beautiful strips of potato. You would cook it in lower oil, in essence, to start to accelerate the cooking process. Then cool that down, or you cool it down for a little bit, let those starches kind of come out. Then turn up the heat and then fry it again and crisp it up. And that's how you make a tostón. So once you get it, once you flatten it in that middle part, you can put it through a tostonera, which is a wooden contraption that actually you can put in the plantain while it's par cooked to get the shape.
Yeah.
And that's in essence what you can do.
Well, you know, one thing that is very, very original in Veracruz is that they make these gorditas infladas, which are like papadums, actually. You know, you make the masa, you cook the plantain in milk. It must be some sort of chemical thing there. And you mash it together. And then you make the, you fry the tortillas and they fluff up. And it's, it could be a dessert or it can be part of a meal, but it has to be eaten right away, obviously.
Exactly.
So it's one of those pleasures that you wait for, and then you fight over when they come to the table.
Another way that I also learned is through Adrian León, which he used to make empanadas with plantains.
Yeah.
It was amazing. The flavors is amazing because you fill it up with the either chicken or fish or pork or beef. And it goes well with all the proteins. It's the amazing of the plantain.
Yeah.
Well, also in Veracruz, you make garnachas with it, with the ripe plantain. You combine it with masa and make these little boat shapes and then fill it up with all these delicious things. By the way, all of these recipes are in my book, Zarelas Veracruz, which is out of print, but you can get it.
I got to get that book.
I think it's an absolute page-turner and an essential in every cook's library.
Thank you. You've always been a
trailblazer, Mom, and your research as an anthropologist through food, doing justice to our cuisine and our culture. So that should never be overlooked.
That's true. That's true. I remember when I met you, I didn't know anything about you. But Douglas Rodriguez informed me, you know, who was Sarah Martinez. And I went to your restaurant of course. And I learned more about you and your history and your life.
I hope you didn't,
as a woman back in the day, is a big achievement.
Well, I remember Douglas going to the restaurant and, you know, I didn't decorate my plates, you know. And he would come in and he said, well, why don't you put a little microgreens and, you know, whatever. He always wanted to change my food. And I said, it's okay. You can do that. I do what I do.
Exactly.
I know, but I think it's important to mention this quick story. You know, the reason I got to start working with you, Jorge, was that my mom had eaten a patria right when we opened.
Yes.
And she did. We had Sunday dinner, and she says, Aaron, you won't believe this food I had. This chef named Douglas Rodriguez from Miami, it's this restaurant on Park Avenue 20th. You got to eat this man's food. It's so amazing. So I had an appointment to go work and interview with Tom Colicchio at Gramercy Tavern when he was the chef. So as I'm walking, it was 1995, because Alex was still there and Mikey was still there.
Yes.
So I walk and I'm going to take an interview at Gramercy Tavern, and then I see the restaurant. And I walk in and I say, hi, I'm Aaron Sanchez. I'm Sarela Martinez's son. Can I speak to the chef? And then Douglas came out. He said, can you start right now? I said, absolutely, sir. And I never went to Gramercy Tavern. And imagine how my career would have changed had I go work with Tom.
I know.
Isn't that just one moment, one decision can change your life and your career?
Exactly.
And you should follow your instincts.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, it's a good lesson for everyone out there.
Yeah.
You know?
I think as we keep on mentioning Douglas Rodriguez, and I think that he is one of the really pioneering people like John George, who that created a cuisine, a genre that lives on and changed the whole aspect of Latin cooking.
You're absolutely right. He brought our cuisine to a different level.
Absolutely.
Yep. And then before him was Felipe Lombardi Rojas.
Rojas Lombardi, who was
Peruvian. He wrote a book called The Art of South American Cooking, which all of you guys should pick up. I think it was published in 86, somewhere around there. It's an absolute staple of Latin cuisine.
He opened the doors.
Yeah, he really opened the doors. And then Douglas really took that, started
to
in Miami
next level.
At UCA, and then brought that to New York. And it was a real game changer. So, Douglas, if you're out there, we love you and we respect you. And thank you for all you contributed.
This episode is brought to you by Apeel. Here at HRN, we care about reducing waste across our food system, from farms to home kitchens. We know that about half of the produce we grow ends up in the trash. We all want to enjoy produce at peak freshness and reduce the amount that gets thrown away. That's where Apeel comes in. Apeel is a plant-based protective layer that helps produce last up to twice as long. It's edible, invisible, and imitates how peels naturally protect fruits and vegetables. Because here's the thing, less waste doesn't just mean we're throwing less food away. It also means we waste less water, energy, and other resources that go into growing produce. Apeel works with nature to reduce waste across the food system from the farm to the kitchen. Apeel helps us conserve our precious resources to ensure we have fresh food to meet our growing need. Apeel, food gone good. Learn more at apeel.com.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and I'm the host of Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I interview extraordinary women in the world of food and wine. And I've expanded this season to create Giving Broadly, a website devoted to amazing products by extraordinary women entrepreneurs. Check it out for great gifts and ways to amp up your cooking this season. That's givingbroadly.com.
You know what I want to tell is you to tell the story of the fish with Jorge who had gone on the stage.
Oh, yeah.
It's my favorite story of all.
Well, see, I don't forget anything. Maybe that's because I stopped smoking pot.
Many stories that I have.
So I remember you told this story when it was like when you first got here, Jorge, was maybe the early 80s or something like that, and you had made up a little money and you were doing something, I don't know, working in restaurants and going to school, and then you finally got up the nerve to get a nice little outfit and invite this beautiful blonde girl out to a date. And you took her to City Island.
Yes.
And then,
my God! Don't bring the story.
No, it's a great story.
So then Jorge he tells the story. He goes, "Man, it was like Saturday Night Fever just came out. I had the big bell bottoms on and the platform shoes, and it, like three buttons down. And then you could barely speak English. You take this hot mamacita out to City Island. You're like, you had a little bit of money. You go, let's buy some of those whole porgies, baby. So." You buy the whole porgies, and then you're trying to watch your manners, and then you start eating the whole thing very, very, you know, astutely and properly, and then it gets to the head, and you just start sucking the eyeballs out of the fish head, and this woman was
staring at me,
and then she probably thought, if he can do that with the fish, imagine what comes later. Right, Jorge?
I don't want to talk about it. It's not the right program for that.
Oh, you don't know.
It was a great day, though.
It was a great day. But that's back in the day.
Back in the day, yes. Well, I grew up, you know, as you know, we eat everything in the animal. I mean, there is not limit for us. But here, it's a different story back then.
Yeah, it was.
Especially back then.
I love
so,
it.
So when I raise my head and I see her staring at me, I'm like, oh. Yeah. Did I break any rules?
Exactly. And I remember.
You didn't suck me any day.
And I remember you were saying, you're like, she was blonde-haired, man, because we had all seen, you know, movies with Marilyn Monroe, and it was like, as a Latino, when you go out with a blonde girl, it means you've made it. You know what I mean?
No, as a matter of fact, the bus boys, they were all looking at me, and I was like, yeah, you know, a big chat. I felt like that. But
I love that. All right, so we talked a little bit about the different styles of the most common, I should say, the green and the sweet plantain. But I think it's important to mention sometimes that there are other kind of other family members of the plantain. You have something called guineos, right? And let's talk a little bit about those, the shorter, stouter little bananas and green plantains that are found all over the Caribbean and other places. Talk a little bit about that, Jorge.
We do, utilize it to mix it with the rice. Mm-hmm. When you do a coconut rice and you chop it up and saute all together. Mm-hmm. I like that, you know, to use them there. Also as a dessert, like tempura and fry them and ice cream next to it with a little panela. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
So guineos are like the smaller green plantains, right?
It has the taste of banana, but a little sweeter.
Yeah.
I found it.
Okay. Outstanding.
I never really worked with that.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important, like when you go and you want to be adventurous and go check out a Latin market, whether you go to the Essex Street Market or you go to La Marqueta up in Harlem, if you're in New York, you know, usually you're going to find your plantains in where you call like the viandas or the tubers. So usually your plantains are going to be next to your malanga, next to your calabaza, next to your boñato, next to all those sort of roots. So when you're there and you're sort of perusing that area, you make sure that you procure the best plantains possible, all right? And like my mother said, plan ahead when you're going to use plantains, whether in the green version or the sweet version.
Well, a wonderful thing to make for a party, I think. I call it a lasagna, but it isn't a lasagna, obviously. I cook the plantains and prepare them, you know, with a jalapeno and garlic and that. Make a layer, then put a layer of black beans, because it goes through, and then top it with mole, and then with cheese, and then and it's just delicious because you make the last.
Yeah, you have all the flavors going on.
Of course, it's very, not very low calorie, but.
Exactly. But I think it's important to mention that plantain is the people's ingredient.
Yes.
It is something that almost every community, all walks of life, socioeconomic backgrounds, people can afford plantains. It's like the tortilla. And it's so, you know, you see its versatility. We've mentioned many different applications and recipes on this podcast, but it's something that I want. If you have not had a chance to cook with plantains, please venture out and start working with these wonderful ingredients. They're humble, they're versatile, they're loaded with flavor, and you can really put your own finger, your fingerprint on it, your own style on these ingredients.
Well, you know, I mentioned sacahuil, and I want to get back to that subject because I didn't explain it very well. In the northern part of Veracruz, in the Huasteca, they make this tamal. In one area, they make it in the oven. Which is what you can do at home. The whole trick is to get the masa to be a little coarse or more coarse, like about the size of a rice kernel. You puree it, mix it up with lots of chicken stock. So the texture is just wonderful. So at home, what I do is line a pot with a lot of banana leaves, banana leaves, put the masa in there and bake it at, you know, like 250 for 8 hours.
Yeah.
And it's so wonderful. I have the recipe up on the website, of course.
You just remind me of the vegetarian tamal that we used to do at Patria. Ayacas.
Ayacas, yeah.
Green plantain, malanga, and boñato, I believe. And we put it all together with a lot of sofrito. We used to make a sofrito, give it a little flavor, and it's all, it was a vegan. Back then, it was a vegan.
Yeah, and remember, tamale. We would grind it through the meat grinder.
Yes, the whole thing.
We would take actually the same bit that you would grind meat to make ground beef. We would actually use that to grind all these different tubers, including the
and
green
the
plantain.
And the binder was the plantain.
Yeah, the binder was the plantain, absolutely.
Because it had the more starch. Yep. And all the ingredients in the
We were ahead of our ahead of the curve now, right? Everyone's like my tío says, you know, I was vegan back in the day because I was poor. We had frijoles, arroz, tortilla.
That's right.
Sopa.
That reminds me of
the original vegans.
Yes, that was the beginning.
Yeah, that reminds me of a story when I was doing my research in my Oaxaca book. Is that I asked one of the people, "What is how has the crisis affected you?" That was the time of the crisis, and he said, "It hasn't affected us at all because we eat beans, chili, you know, tomatoes, and that we always have plenty of."
We are going back in time. We are going back in basics.
Exactly.
That's what we learn. I agree with you 100%. I mean, we find now that the whole culinary
landscape
has grown.
Yeah.
Now we have more ingredients to play with, and we mix the cultures.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I take a little bit from Mexico, I take a little from China, and mix it up from my country. And now you see in American restaurants using our ingredients. I mean, ají de amarillo, plantains, moles, ceviches, and you name it.
This is an exciting time. And I think it's important to mention that on this podcast, cooking in Mexican from A to Z.
You're the A and I'm the Z.
Yes. And a big part of a big aim is to celebrate the ingredients that really define Mexican cuisine.
And that people don't know how to use.
Exactly.
That's what we're trying to do. Is so many ingredients are available now, but people don't know how to use them. And this is the aim of cooking in Mexican from A to Z.
Exactly. We want this to be educational, fun, And we want everyone to embrace these ingredients in our food. And this podcast is gonna show you the way. And I think, Jorge, you brought up something interesting. I know when I started cooking as in the younger part of my career, I thought about doing what Douglas did, redefining Latin cuisine with contemporary technique, using high-end ingredients and, you know, and creating this sort of hybrid Latin cuisine. And now as I've gotten older, I find myself going back to grandma's kitchen and the simple techniques. And that is more appealing to chefs as we get older.
The apple doesn't fall apart far away from the tree. Yeah. So we have to go back to the roots and kind of like reorganize our thoughts. Mm-hmm. Now that life is changing with all these new forms of life, mm-hmm. you know, being vegan, gluten-free, and dairy-free.
Paleo.
And like your uncle said, I was a vegan back then. I was a vegan too. You know, we used to eat more vegetables than today.
More out of necessity.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's important. And the hardest thing that we find in restaurants is how do you teach a young cook, a young person, mm-hmm. the simplicity and how to create awesome full food with five ingredients? Exactly. You know, and that's what Jonathan Waxman does so perfectly. You give him five ingredients, he can make a recipe sing. And that's the big thing that we struggle with now is to teach kids the beauty in simple food.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was talking to Sue Torres, you know, the younger chef who had that restaurant called Sueños. And they're talking to her about consulting to do a Mexican vegan restaurant. And, I mean, 2 years ago I would have said, you know, forget it. But now I say, go for it, girl.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. No, totally. I mean, New York has changed a lot, and I love New York because it's a multicultural city, mm-hmm. and you have all these ingredients and cultures that you learn from. Mm-hmm. And then, like I said before, I mean, life has changed so much that now we take care of our bodies. Mm-hmm. And I could see that. I could see the Mexican vegan.
Yeah, me too. But it's taken a readjustment of mindset.
I mean, it is crazy to think that Patria opened 25, 26 years ago.
Yep.
To think about that, you know, that time and how much Latin cuisine has grown, its awareness, it's the access to ingredients, how people's knowledge of Latin cuisine now differentiating, guess what? Peruvian food's not Mexican food, the basic stuff.
Yeah.
The regionality is being understood now more so that by the layman, by the person at home now. So people always talk about trends. What's the next trend? I really do feel that people are going to start to break down Mexican regional cuisine.
Yeah.
You're going to start to see restaurants that are focused only on barbacoa.
Exactly.
You're going to see restaurants that are only going to be focused on food from Veracruz. You know what I mean? And that's what I think is happening now. It is happening, but it's going to be more prevalent.
Let's talk really quickly about regional cuisine. What happened was, you know, the Spanish brought the ingredients from the old world, mm-hmm. and the spices, the chickens, your pork, all that, and the Mexicans combined it with our traditional ingredients, but those traditional ingredients were regional.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is that if the Spanish ingredients came to Oaxaca, the local people combined it with their mm-hmm. local exactly. ingredients, and that was Oaxacan cuisine, and mm-hmm. that happened in Yucatan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that happened all over. I mean, you think about there not being any horses in the New World before the Spaniards.
Yeah.
I mean, stuff like that. But, you know, one interesting thing that's happened, and I think it's important to mention, is my mom talked about the Spanish contribution. Think about what their agenda was, right? They wanted to find El Dorado, the city of gold, right?
But not only Spanish, French, too.
Yeah, yeah. The Europeans. But they wanted to convert the indigenous people to Christianity.
Yeah.
So they brought olive oil for communion. They brought vinis vinifera, red wine. And they brought wheat. So for the body of Christ. So that was another part of a series of ingredients that affected culturally Mexico.
And then, so next season, we're going to concentrate on how the Spanish, the old world ingredients,
mm-hmm.
and how we have adapted it over many, many years of this mestizo cooking.
Yep. And how they've been adopted into what current Mexican food is all about. I think it's important. We'll touch upon that on season two. What can I say, Jorge?
Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor, a pleasure. And like I said before, I'm very proud of you, your career. I always admire Zarela, of course. one of my heroes in the beginning of my career. I read your books, some of them. I got to get the next ones. I can't wait for yours. I'm waiting. I'm still waiting for you. Yeah, the last
one. I'll get you because you're very much featured in my memoir, Where I Come From, Life Lessons of a Latino Chef, available now from Abrams Book, published by Abrams. It's a fantastic read.
It's a beautiful book.
And what's really special for, I know, my mom and myself is to have you here because you played such a pivotal role in the early parts of my career. And there were times where I was this close to being fired or I was messing up. And Jorge would always have my back. And he says, no, this kid has something. You have to stick with him. Because when people act out, especially young people, they're asking for attention. And I needed the attention. Jorge gave it to me. He stuck there with me. And look where I'm at now. So exactly. I really, really believe that you had a huge role in that, and I thank you for sticking with me.
I'm glad that you didn't lose the bet.
Yeah, thank you. Now everyone's like, well, I knew he had it in him, so I really appreciate it, Jorge.
No, good. I'm, but like I said before, I'm very happy where you are. Congratulations. Keep going. I mean, it's great that you are having this conversation about your country and your culture and what brings to America. And we have to learn.
Absolutely.
Learning is a good thing, you know. We are not afraid.
Yeah.
And people are interested.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's what the best part about it. And one great thing about podcasts is that even if they miss it on the day that it's going to run the first time, they can always go back.
Absolutely.
You know,
Access it.
Like that. Yeah, back in the day, people were afraid of chiles.
Yeah.
I believe now everybody's using chiles now.
Yeah, and you can give access to them as well.
Exactly, they're all over the place. You know.
We encourage everybody to keep listening to Cooking in Mexico from A to Z, right here on HRN. We're excited to continue to present more podcasts with beautiful ingredients, celebrating the culture of Mexico, the ingredients, how to use them, their techniques. And then all backed up with wonderful stories. And you can imagine that this is going to continue going and we're going to continue to have fun and inspire all of you. Thank you so much for joining us and Cooking in Mexico from A to Z. I'm Aaron Sanchez.
And I'm Sarela Martinez. And here we are with Jorge, the gorgeous Jorge.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for listening. Cooking in Mexican from A to Z is powered by Simple Cast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without your support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Entrañas.